Hello, memory miners, composers, and artistic word warriors. Welcome to another episode of Right Minded, where today we're going to be talking about setting aside judgments, which is not the same as setting aside our opinions or even our biases, which are critical to weaving an authentic narrative. And I am joined today by my ever clear-eyed co-host, Grant Faulkner. And Grant, we're covering an interesting topic today, that of how writers can avoid being too recriminating in their work, whether that's of themselves or other real life characters or of their protagonists. And with memoir, of course, it's easy to understand that writers may come to the page with angry feelings toward people they're writing about, where people have felt wronged and may feel inclined at times to lash out. But I think it's true that novelists need to be thinking about this topic too, and especially if a character is particularly flawed or maybe based on someone in the author's own life. So I'm wondering if you have seen this play out in fiction too, that readers need to sort out their judgments in order to create more authentic characters.
Yeah, absolutely. If a writer is judging a character too much, no matter if the character is based on a real life character or completely imagined, it usually comes out on the page and makes that character weaker as a result. Because we want to experience people not as a judgment, but as a fully rounded person with layers and possibilities. I mean, do you want to go out for drinks with a judgment or go on a hike with a judgment? It's just no fun. A character that is judged loses his or her wonderful complexities. And I remember a recent interview we did with Adrienne Brodeur about her memoir, Wild Game. And Adrienne taped some writing advice by Vivian Gornick on her computer screen, which said that for the drama to deepen, we must see the loneliness of the monster and the cunning of the innocent. And that's great advice. And the best way to write a villain is to focus on that character's good traits and vice versa for a protagonist, because all characters need room to be rational and irrational, good and bad. And on another note, I think that writers often, you know, choose to write fiction in order to create distance from a character they feel so strongly about and feel so many judgments about. And I've heard many novelists say this. So I know that memoir writers might have to grapple with this question of judgment more than fiction writers, particularly in cases where someone in their real life might have harmed them or truly done wrong by them.
Yeah, it's a tough issue that writers have to work around and sometimes examine. And we're super lucky today to be speaking with Jeanette Walls, because the brilliance of her best-selling memoir, The Glass Castle, is her ability to write without judgment of her parents, who were a bit off the wall, to put it mildly. They both likely suffered from manic depression. Her father was an alcoholic, and Jeanette herself has said that many people tell her, that they relate to her father because they also grew up in an abusive family. But she also had a very absent mother who was not a particularly good parent to her. Her father subjects her to some truly difficult things, like throwing her in the water to teach her to swim, later when she's a little older, pimping her out to a friend. So there is just a lot of stuff going on in this story: neglect, false and broken promises, not to mention the poverty and the constant moving and the bizarre behavior of her parents. And yet she has this capacity to write dispassionately. And I think it's this dispassion that a lot of readers commend for being non-judgmental despite everything. And readers have marveled at her lack of judgment. I mean, it comes up time and again in interviews with her. And I've watched those interviews and read certain things that she's said. And it's clear that one of the primary reasons she was able to write in this way was because she loved her parents despite everything. And she was able ultimately to find their strengths despite their very clear shortcomings. And then probably too, the aspect of forgiveness, you know, forgiving them for what they subjected her to. And it's not, you know, just that she says these things are so, you know, because it's easy just to go like, yeah, I forgive. You know, I believe she's internalized that, and it's enabled her to write compassionately and without recrimination and to let readers make up those judgments for themselves.
It's interesting because I can't remember any authors who I've talked with who have told me that they wrote a character or a story out of anger or a need to condemn. And I haven't read any interviews with authors that have revealed this either. And I think we sometimes have that feeling when our anger is really intense or our resentment's really intense in real life, that maybe we'll get our revenge on the page someday. But that's just such a bad place to write from. And I think good writers and good people realize this. For one, who wants to wake up every day when you're writing a memoir or a novel and just wake up to spewing anger and recriminations on the page? It's just a bad way to live in the end. Also, I think there's something about the act of writing that extinguishes those feelings. Writing is a better vehicle for exploration and understanding. So I think the feelings of anger tend to be modulated in the process of creation itself. A good writer knows what they have to do to write good characters in the end, in other words, and they move beyond that anger as they write.
Yeah, so true. And Mary Carr famously shared how she wrote those three drafts of her memoir Lit, one in which her ex-husband was all wrong, the next draft where she was all wrong, and then the final draft where what happened was either no one's fault or both of their faults equally. And I think it takes time to gain distance from your own life and your own experience. And in memoir, I see a lot of students who are still processing. You know, they're still angry, they're still blaming. And, you know, I don't think that all writers have to forgive. I certainly don't subscribe to that. You don't have to forgive a perpetrator or someone who wronged you or violated you. But if you're going to write about them in a meaningful way, you do have to access their humanity. And so, like, considering their own wounds, their motivations, their drives, their sickness, if that's the case. And here we can certainly point to fictional examples. And I'm thinking of protagonists like Humbert Humbert in Lolita, or Patrick Bateman in American Psycho, or the murderers in Capote's In Cold Blood. Certainly not saying you like those characters or that you're rooting for them. They're emotionally disturbed. But then those authors had to get inside their heads. And to write those characters well, you can't condemn them. You can show what's wrong with them, you know, and that's where the clarity comes in. And this is what you're, you know, like, you're witnessing who they are and not bringing to the page your own feelings around morality or ideas that they should be better people.
Yeah, I think as you're reading down that list, Brooke, I thought we should make a grand list of problematic, dangerous characters who we might hate in real life, but who are gripping on the page and we want to be with in some strange way. And I'm thinking of, you know, the character Meursault and Albert Camus, The Stranger, or Tom Ripley and The Talented Mr. Ripley, Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment, which is one of my favorites, or Michael Corleone in The Godfather. These characters are responsible for a lot of deaths and not a whole lot of goodness, and yet they're some of the best characters in literature. And now that I'm just talking about this, I wish there was a class, probably is somewhere, special class on how to write characters effectively who are, you know, really bad, but who are really good on the page, to figure out the art of it. With memoir, though, I think it's more challenging because the heinous acts actually occurred. And I think, as you touched on, sometimes that forgiveness is harder to get over. So it's harder to get those words on the page. And now that I'm a parent, I find that I often have an especially tough time reading about kids enduring horrific treatment at the hands of their parents in memoirs. And I suppose I read on one hand to fathom that, but in the end, you know, some of those acts are just totally unfathomable to me.
Yeah. And there's a powerful scene in The Glass Castle when Jeanette is at the zoo and her father sticks his hand into a cheetah's cage to pet the cheetah. Just pet the cheetah at the zoo. But then beckons Jeanette to do the same. And that scene is just so outrageous. I mean, it obviously it's like maybe there are striations of abusive behavior, but there are a lot of scenes that are just so wildly irresponsible and reckless. But Jeanette doesn't need to tell us those things are true, right? She doesn't need to explain to the reader that it's not right to put your kid's hand into a cheetah cage, or that her father was bad because he did X, Y, or Z. We can see it and we can make up our own minds. And so the fact is that it is shocking to read, and the reaction of the other adults in the scenes are often also to be shocked, right? And so she has all these ways to let us know that it's chaotic, that it's off. And then there are the social norms and the general agreed upon behaviors that we have as human beings, where you're like, well, you just don't do things like that. You don't pet wild animals at zoos. You don't throw your kids into the river to learn how to swim, or, you know, leave them behind. I mean, he just does all this wild stuff. And so really the fact that she's able to just show us what happened is actually quite powerful. And I love that she just lets her parents be who they were. And so you decide whether or not you feel negative toward them, or whether you think they're just unique and complex. Because the fact is that there are all kinds of humans after all, you know, and what makes the world so interesting is that we're not all perfect citizens, you know, doing all the right things. And it's also what makes memoir and fiction so darn compelling.
Yeah, I do want to point out that one thing that makes the book work, despite, you know, some of the confrontations with this reckless, irresponsible, dangerous behavior, is that she balances it with charming touches. And I like how she captures her mom's great gift for rationalizing, for instance, you know, when they move into an apartment with walls so thin that they hear all their neighbors. Her mom, you know, said it was a bonus because they'd pick up a little Spanish without even studying. I love that. And then that's the way I want to learn Spanish. And then one year for Christmas, her father walked each child into the Arizona desert at night and let each one claim a star for their Christmas present. And I wish I would have done that with my kids. I think that's brilliant. And I also like the kids, you know, they have this interesting resilience in the story. The kids, for instance, the children painted their skin so the holes in their pants didn't show. And then Jeanette, who was buck-toothed as a child, tried making her own braces when she heard what orthodontia costs. So there's so many moments like that that also make you understand how such a life and love is possible in that environment.
Yeah, and thanks for recalling all of those scenes. I mean, there's just so many moments and so many fabulous memories that Jeanette brings to the page. And The Glass Castle is one of those memoirs that has had such a deep effect on so many readers. You know, it's a book that people can see aspects of their own stories in. And I've taught it actually to my memoir students. And it was just really exciting to see what Jeanette gets right, you know, from her portrayal of the characters to her deep, detailed scene development and how she captures what happens in these short vignettes that keep the story moving along. So super excited to talk to her today.
Yeah. Well, let's hurry up and get through this break then so we can get on with it.
Hi there. This isn't a sponsored spot, but a personal notice that I'd like to share with any memoirists out there, aspiring or in progress. On May 1st, I'm hosting a day of memoir, craft, and inspiration with my memoir co-teacher, Linda Joy Myers. And this day is all about infusing energy into your memoir idea or writing. We're bringing Elizabeth Gilbert of Eat, Pray, Love fame to talk about memoir, something she rarely does these days. So it's going to be inspiring and fun. And also my friends, Joshua Moore, author of the memoir Sirens, who will be teaching about voice, and literary agent Aaliyah Hannah Habib, talking about what memoirists in particular need to know about shopping and selling their books to agents and editors. This is 5 hours of content, which will be live via webinar on May 1st. And if you have to miss any or all of it, we record. We never sell these classes after the fact, so it's a one-time opportunity. I hope you'll check this out at www.magicofmemoir.com. Thank you, and thanks for listening to Right Minded. Well, hello, everybody. We are back, and we have the great honor to have Jeanette Walls with us. And Jeanette is the author of the New York Times bestselling memoir, The Glass Castle, which was on the bestseller list for more than 6 years and which has sold well over 6 million copies. And she's also the author of Half Broke Horses, named one of the 10 best books of 2009 by the editors of the New York Times Book Review. And before becoming an author, she was a gossip columnist at New York Magazine, and she covered gossip also for MSNBC. She's a graduate of Barnard College and now lives in rural Virginia with her husband, the writer John Taylor. Jeanette, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
We're so thrilled to have you here. And I want to start by sharing with you that I teach memoir. And I think my students have so much to learn from The Glass Castle for so many reasons. But one of the reasons I want to address here today is about what I call writing dispassionately. And to me, that's writing without judgment, without, you know, emotional attachment. And so in your story, all of these terrible things happen, but often you are not really writing about how you feel. And certainly you don't pass judgments. You're basically letting the reader make that decision for themselves. So I was curious if you could talk about that and if you had to work to get there or if that came naturally.
Thank you for complimenting that, because some people find issue with that. They think I should be passing judgment. I personally disagree. I'll tell you, first of all, thank you for the very kind words, but I wrote the first version of The Glass Castle in 6 weeks, and then I spent 5 years rewriting it, and I was just trying to make it more honest. And by honest, I don't mean not lying. I mean, what I was really feeling. And the first version that I wrote in 6 weeks was very removed. As you mentioned, I have a background in journalism, and it was almost too dispassionate. It was sort of like, I had heretofore not considered the plethora of influences. And I found that only by going back, if I wrote it from the perspective as an adult, I kept on passing judgment on my parents. But if I wrote it from the perspective of a child, and a child doesn't realize how weird its situation is, it thinks that that's normal. So that's what I did. I made the decision not to write as an adult looking back, but as a child who just accepted this bizarre situation as normal. And yes, I did make a conscious decision not to say that my parents were good or bad. I mean, some people who read The Glass Castle think that my parents are monsters, and some think that they were really neat people with flaws. And I think that's great. That's the way it should be. That's the way it is in real life. We can all look at one president and some person sees him as a hero and another sees him as a villain. And that's the way life is. So I think that was something that I wanted to do, is just leave it open to the reader to decide what they thought of this story.
That's so interesting, Jeanette. And the movie of your book came out in 2017. And based on the accounts I've read, you were happy with how it was treated. You wrote that you worried it would be Hollywoodized and you desperately didn't want that. I'm curious, now that a couple of years have passed, what is your favorite part? And is there anything you wish had been handled differently?
You know, Grant, I was so in awe of those actors. I really think that they taught me a lot about empathy and understanding other people's story without passing judgment. And when they hired Woody Harrelson to play the role of my father, I thought, he doesn't look like my dad, but he's a good actor. He's Woody. What the heck? And then when I saw him in character for the first time, I started shaking and crying. He nailed it. He got it so solidly. And I was watching a scene in which my character was leaving home and he was asking her to stay. And at first they were on script and then they went off script. And when they went off script, Woody Harrelson said things that my father had said that I hadn't told him. And I was just blown away. So for me to say, well, I wish they'd done this differently, or I was glad they did this, I'm not a movie maker. I'm not a screenwriter. I was happy to shove this big mess of a story over to these people and let them turn it into a movie. And I thought they were not just respectful, but they were almost reverential about getting it right, about understanding these crazy, complicated people. And like I said, I think they taught me something about empathy. And I think that the director, who did a lot of the screenwriting, I think he taught me a lot about storytelling, because they had to cut and condense so many things. And every time I said, well, why did you cut this out? Or why did you smush these two scenes together? His answers were always so brilliant that I just said, let me step back and let these guys do what they do.
Oh, it's interesting to hear about that process. And I said in the intro that the book has sold well over 6 million copies. I'm sure it's nearly to 7, if not there by now. It's a staggering number of books. And I read an op-ed you wrote in the Los Angeles Times that came out around the time of the movie. And you shared that you worried, or maybe just imagined, that people wouldn't understand your life. But then you wrote these words, which I'm going to quote: "I was so wrong. People understood sometimes better than I did. And to this day, I'm astonished and very humbled by the way the story has been embraced." And so I wanted to ask you about this reception by millions and what that feels like, and also about the legacy of your parents and what it means to you to have captured in this way, not only for eternity, but also for so many people's eyes to be on.
You know, Brooke, it has been quite the journey, honestly. I'm just a girl with a white trash story. I honestly did not expect, I have to say, though, that it just, the amazing thing to me has been how many kids will come up to me and say, I hate reading and I hate books, but your story really resonated with me, of course, everybody loves stories. They just need to find stories about people like them. And I think that is what memoir writing is all about. I think that sometimes we memoirs get a little bit of a bum rap. People think that we're these exhibitionists trying to you got to feel sorry for me, all these things happened. But what we're doing is saying, this is what I went through. This is my journey. And maybe you can learn something from it without the nasty business of actually having to go through it. And people who've never experienced anything like that, in my experience, are so open to listening and to understanding. And people who have gone through something like that find solace in the fact that somebody else has been there. And we make these amazing emotional connections that I never expected. And it's transformed the world for me from a place filled with potential enemies to a place filled with potential friends, because complete strangers will come up and they'll start unburdening themselves to me. And sometimes they're crying and they'll say, "No, but I've never told anybody this before. I think you'll understand." And they tell me these stories that I hear as triumphant and beautiful, but they're still ashamed. And I don't know whether to shake them by the shoulders or hug them, but then I remember, oh yeah, I was ashamed too. And that's why I'm such a fan of storytelling. A very wise man once said to me, secrets are a little bit like vampires. They suck the life out of you, but they can exist only in the darkness. And once they're exposed to the light, there's a moment of horror, but then poof, they disappear. And I found that to be so true. I carried this story around, this poor white trash story, thinking that it somehow made me less of a person and that people who had better lives would look down their nose at me. And I've just found it to be the opposite. So I'm on a bit of a campaign for people to tell their stories, because I think that so often these secrets that we carry around that we think that make us less of a person are actually the best thing we have going for them, for us. And only by confronting these secrets, by shining our light in the dark corners, are we able to take advantage of these things we've all gone through and put these things to work for us. And in the process, and this was what I did not expect, but help other people who are grappling with the same issues. I think that very often to protect ourselves, we isolate ourselves. And it does insulate us, but we're cutting off a potential source of strength and love of other people who have been through similar things and are willing to share our stories.
I love that metaphor of the vampire and the light. You've said that you can't make stuff up, or maybe that you don't think you're particularly good at making things up. So I'm curious if you could tell us about the choice to write fiction after The Glass Castle, since your subsequent two books have been novels, and you know, if they share some of that shining the light on the vampire.
Well, the type of fiction that I'm drawn to is very close to nonfiction. And I think that we all draw on our experiences. I was once on a panel with a writer, Lisa DeGenoa, and somebody asked her, "What's the best advice anybody's ever given you for writing fiction?" And she said, "Take an acting class." And at the time, it struck me as a sort of odd thing to hear. But now I get it, because I believe when we're making things up, they still have to be real. They have to feel real. They have to resonate. You have to be able to transport the reader into some universe. And you have to take experiences that are relatable. So like I said, the sort of fiction that I'm drawn to, whether it's science fiction or anything, it draws on people's experiences. The emotions are real. The characters feel real. So, you know, where does imagination come from? How do we make things up? And in my experience, it's very often drawing on things that we've already been through, things that we know.
Well, and you start The Glass Castle, I'm going to go back to that for a sec, because of memory and other questions that are, I think, curiosities to our listeners. There's a scene, and you're just 3 years old in the beginning. You said in an interview I watched that if you write memoir, you have to be prepared for a lot of people to call you a liar. And I can only imagine how often people have been incredulous about your story, because I work with memoirists and I see that coming up all the time. And so I just want to go back to this opening scene. There's lots of scenes in the book that feel a little crazy, to say the least. But in this one, you're 3 years old and you're cooking yourself a hot dog. And when I've talked to my students about your class, some readers have felt, well, I don't believe she remembered that because she was so young, or that seems so extreme, you know, when she fell out of the car, any number of things. And the reason I raise this is just because I'd love to hear your perspective on that. And I'm wondering what you make of your own memory, and especially very early memories, and how you advise people to think about them and put them on the page.
It's an excellent question and something I love talking about. You know, it's funny, when you write a memoir, people think you made it up. And when you write fiction, people think it's based on real life. So when I wrote that scene, my husband, he was with me every step on the way. And he said, okay, this scene's really going to depend on detail. So put in all the detail you remember. And so I went and I typed it all up and I showed it to him. He said, Jeanette, you can take some of that detail out, because I remember that scene so vividly about being burned. I remember the heat on my face. I remember so much about the texture of the car that I drove in, because I'd never been in such a clean car before. It was our neighbor's. And I talked to one time an expert in memory, and he was telling me that traumatic memories are stored in a certain part of the brain where they're more accessible. It's for evolutionary reasons, in case you encounter that sort of problem again. But in layman's terms, they haunt you. And so very often when my memory on this event is challenged, I like to do a show of hands. How many people remember something from age 3? How many people remember something from age earlier? And usually those early memories are traumatic. I have terrible memory for names. I have no sense of direction. But for whatever reason, I seem to be able to remember events pretty well. That being said, any nonfiction depends on recounting what we know or believe we know. And, you know, there's all this talk about how memoirs are allowed to make things up. And I couldn't disagree more. I absolutely disagree. Writing a memoir, it's all about being honest. It's all about being truthful and getting as close as you can to the truth. And no nonfiction gets the absolute truth. And the leeway you're allowed is a matter of perspective. I mean, another incident in the Glass Castle is when my father gave us children a star for Christmas. We had no money for Christmas presents, so we all got to pick out our own star. And it's my very favorite memory. It's just something that I carry it around. It's a treasure. My older sister, when she talks about that memory, she said, isn't that like that sorry SOB dad of ours to give away something that didn't belong to him in the first place? And my brother, on the other hand, does a hilarious impersonation of my father being drunk and giving a star. So it's the same memory, told three different ways, but the same fact. So that's the leeway, I believe, that a memoirist is allowed to make up. But so far as early memories, I dug as deeply as I can. I think that once you start going back, it's like pulling on a thread and other things start coming back to you. But there are a lot of things that I didn't include just because there were too many memories. But beyond that, it was a little fuzzy. And if you really don't remember what happened, either say you don't remember or leave it out. You don't fudge things. You don't make things up. Because I think that being truthful and honest, it's so important. And the details, I wouldn't have said I remember being something being red if I don't remember it being red. I didn't need to make things up. These things really stayed with me. I didn't show the Glass Castle to most members of my family because most people weren't interested in it. My mom wasn't interested in reading it while I was writing it. Neither was my older sister. My brother read it, and he has a steel trap memory. And when he read it, the events jibed up almost perfectly with what he remembered. You know, that being said, he has a different perspective on things. The facts were the same.
Jeanette, The Glass Castle was your first book, and it became an instant classic, of course. I'm curious what it was like, though, emotionally to follow up The Glass Castle with subsequent books. I can imagine, you know, you might have felt a lot of pressure to get it right or to succeed on the same level.
Well, you know, Hack Broke Horses was almost a prequel. I called it fiction just because it was all for my mother, and I don't know how much it was true. I'd originally wanted to write her story, but she was the one who urged me to write about her mother, my grandmother, Lily Casey Smith, who was a foul-mouthed, gun-toting, hooch-selling school teacher. And I wrote it in my grandmother's voice, and I tried to get it, again, as close as I could to the truth, but I called it fiction because I had to make up certain things because I just didn't know. And since it was first person, I can't say, I don't know exactly what happened to me during those years. So I fudged a couple of things, and just, they weren't huge things, but just things I wasn't certain about, and I called it fiction. The same with The Silver Star. It was based on a combination of things that really happened.
Well, and to follow up on that point, actually, this line between truth and fiction, and you did know this story, and yet it sounds by what you're saying, and you know, for those of us who know your mother through the book, your mom may have been unreliable, needless to say. And sometimes I go to writers' conferences and people will tell me that they're writing fictionalized memoirs. And my response is always unequivocally to inform them that that's not a genre, right? That there's fiction or there's memoir. And so you skirted that a little bit by calling this a true life novel. And I was really interested to know just how that process went, especially in the publishing world that seems to want to create such bright lines between fiction and memoir.
Well, I originally started out trying to write it as nonfiction. I was trying to write my mother's story. And there were just so many gaps that I can't call this nonfiction and I can't call it a memoir. And people said, oh yeah, you can, you just made up a few things. You know, and I would agree with you, there's no such thing as fictionalized memoir. It's fiction or nonfiction. A true life novel was actually taken from Executioner's Song. That was not my idea. But I thought it was almost too coy to say that I completely made it up. It relied so heavily on my mother's story and my grandmother's story that I felt I couldn't take credit and say that it was completely a work of fiction. And a lot of people have asked me, well, how much did you make up? And I can't even assign a percent. And I wasn't trying to be clever or cutesy. It was just sort of like, this is as close to the truth as I can get it, but I can't call it the truth. So I called it a true life novel.
Well, I think a lot of people are doing that kind of thing, and that genre is increasingly right now maybe blurring the lines a bit. There are novelists who are adapting stylistic things that are more common to memoir, for instance. And so given that, what advice do you have for people who are writing between the genres? I mean, was there anything that you learned that you want to impart or anything that you would have done differently?
Well, you know, people often ask me for advice about writing memoirs. And first thing I tell them is just don't worry whether it's good or bad. Don't worry what people are going to think. I mean, people really grapple with these tough issues. And it's one thing to make the decision to expose and potentially humiliate yourself, but to do it to a loved one or whatever. And what I often tell people is just go ahead and write it. And if there's something that you can't live with people knowing this about yourself or about somebody else, just change some details and call it fiction. You know, that's my advice. If you decide for whatever reason that you don't want to write a memoir, just cover up some identifying details and call it fiction. I think some very good and very powerful fiction has come from that place. I mean, when I was a kid, my favorite book was A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. It was almost certainly based on her life, but for whatever reason, she didn't want to call it a memoir, and that's fine. They're both very, very powerful storytelling platforms, both memoir and fiction. And my only issue is don't call something a memoir if you're going to put in some things that aren't true or that are fictionalized. It's a disservice to the truth. It's a disservice to people who turn to you to find out, well, how did she or he get through poverty or homelessness or addiction or whatever. You have to be honest. If you don't want to be completely honest, then call it fiction.
Well, with that, Jeanette, thank you for the permission, not only on that point, but also more generally. I know how much a champion you are of people who want to tell your stories, and we're very grateful for that. And we're so grateful that you could be with us today. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Jeanette.
Thank you.
Everybody, we'll be right back with Brooke's Takeaway today.
So everybody, today's takeaway is how to gauge your dispassion. And this is a writing prompt. It's a popular one I use with my memoir students, and it's to imagine the house that you grew up in. So spend a moment envisioning the home, its rooms, the layout of the house. For some people, this is going to be an apartment. In some cases, I've had students who remembered a car or a shelter. So whatever it was for you is what it was. Recall a tough scene, something that actually happened to you, a fight with a parent or a sibling, something that might have happened in one of these rooms. And once you've landed on the memory, jot down what you feel. Not the scene itself, but what do you feel? What are the emotions that are evoked from the memories that have negative associations? What are you harboring? And this is not about trying to make you feel badly for being pissed off at someone. That part is fine. It's simply trying to see, this many years later, What kinds of emotions you still have access to? Are you angry and rageful? Are you despairing and sad? Are you torn? Is what you remember emotionally raw, or do you not feel anything? And do you have distance between your current self and that memory? So write down an insight or two, and at the end of the exercise, you know, just hold on to it, and maybe you can come back to it later and write the scene if you're so moved.
Thanks so much for the great takeaway, Brooke. And I want to leave with a great, I was very uplifted by this comment from Tracy M. on the iTunes comments. She says, Tracy says, I feel like I'm hanging out with two uber smart writers and getting their best advice. As a writer, I face all the fears about my art and sharing it with the world. Brooke and her co-host, that's me, help me realize that all of this is normal. I like the shows with interviews too. Keep them coming. Yes, Tracy, we will keep them coming. This is Right Minded is a weekly podcast, so thanks for tuning in every week for some of you. And you can download it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And we love reviews like Tracy's. So please, please tell us how we're doing. And we will see you next week. Thank you.